Coming up on Weekend America.
When Dave Harmon parks his Hummer, people leave notes on his windshield.
She said the least I could do would be to put one of the Support Our Troop ribbons on the back if I'm going to be using all the gas that they're losing their lives to get me.
This weekend, some people are selling their Hummers, but who's buying? I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. If you do sell your car, you can always take the horse.
It seemed like every bank employee came running to the window and said, "What's going on?" You know, and everybody was taking pictures. Of course, when he left a deposit, they got a big laugh.
The drive-thru becomes a gallop-thru. And Tamara's father went through something bad in Vietnam.
I have faint memories of visiting him in a mental ward at a VA hospital.
I was just not adjusting well to being back in the world.
What happened to her dad, and does she really want to know? Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul. Now, this Father's Day weekend, you might be enjoying a meal with dear old dad. But what are you going to talk about? Later this hour, we'll meet a daughter who found out the hard way that some conversations need to be left alone. Plus, we're going to take a summer road trip to look at an old California barn. What are you doing this weekend?
I think I might go out to Idaho to visit my grandmother.
I'm going to see the Sex and the City movie.
I might go to Tina's birthday.
My birthday is on Saturday, and I'm turning 10.
I don't have any specific plans for this weekend. I might try and go see Shakespeare in the Park.
Hopefully Sunday I'll be spending it with my father, Father's Day.
My plans for this weekend is to become more knowledgeable about the human condition. I'm going to continue that, by the way, not just this weekend.
I'm going to play a nice, relaxing game of golf. That's what I'm doing this weekend. I get a weekend off.
The human condition?
Definitely
golf?
More than a weekend endeavor, huh?
Maybe they're the same.
Those voices came from New York, St. Paul, and Bothell, Washington.
If you are planning a getaway by car this weekend, I hope for you that it's downhill both ways. Gasoline is over $4 a gallon now. A lot of us are making changes. General Motors says it might sell off its Hummer division, which makes GM sound like a lot of households. We have just got to get rid of this SUV.
Mm-hmm.
GM says domestic sales of Hummers are down 30%. Although if you think about it, that means 70% of the Hummer business is still happening. Who are these people? Weekend America's John Moe went in search of the modern Hummer economy.
Dave Harmon of Cedar, Minnesota, knew it wasn't exactly an economy car.
Well, it's a jacked-up 7-inch lift with 33-inch mud tires on a Hummer H2 2003. Gas mileage has been cut about in half to about 6 miles a gallon. And just like most of the stuff we purchase as toys, it just proved I was an idiot.
Dave's Hummer weighs 3.5 tons, and that's not counting the hate mail.
Yeah, I get a lot of notes on the windows leaving it. I'm not patriotic and I don't support our troops and the whole thing, you know, for the gas mileage and everything. I actually saw a lady at Home Depot putting one in my door. She said the least I could do would be to put one of the Support Our Troop ribbons on the back if I'm going to be using all the gas that they're losing their lives to get me.
Most of us first saw the Hummer in the first Gulf War. Stormman Norman Schwarzkopf riding one during Desert Storm. The Hummer meant American power and victory. Eventually, they became available even to construction guys like Dave, who bought his a couple of years ago for his business. He was in new home construction. But the economy sputtered, the business failed, and the war became a mess. So, Hummer for sale.
And any bites? No. No emails, no phone calls. I can't even bring it to Rudy Luther's and find out what they'd pay me just to buy it back. They just laugh. Nobody wants anything to do with it.
But some people still want everything to do with Hummers.
I don't know. Basically, when I saw one, I was like, oh, well, you know, I got to get one of those, you know.
For Mike Bramall of Wisconsin, that's all that mattered. He's owned 5 Hummers, belongs to a Hummer club. He is crazy about them. But will he break the habit with gas prices so high?
No. Take it to the grave. There's really nothing like driving it. I mean, it's like almost like a tank. You know, you got this little cockpit area, you know, it's nice and snug, and you got this little dash. It looks like a control panel on a fighter jet or something.
The military symbolism holds up for Mike. Tanks, jet fighters. It's one of the reasons he'll buy more Hummers. Mike uses his Mercedes for around town, drives the Hummer on weekends. Because he can afford to. At Wally McCarthy's Hummer dealership in Roseville, Minnesota, salesmen stare out the window, just hoping that customers like Mike walk up to the lot. Sales manager Bill Emstead insists the mileage isn't that bad.
Our vehicles get fair, respectable mileage, mid to upper 20s. An SUV that'll give you 20 miles per gallon, people find that more than respectable.
The research I saw said that it was between like 12 and 18 miles a gallon.
Well, that's not our experience. I happen to own an H3, and on the road, it gives us just on the sunny side of 20 miles per gallon.
Bill's claims are pretty different from what the government says you can expect. But that's not how they sell the Hummer anyway. The Hummer economy has shaken out people who need to care about that. A vehicle built for soldiers is now available exclusively to generals. Salesman Jim York took me out on the test track, an ersatz rocky terrain in front of the showroom.
Right now, this is the position we're at now is called nothing but rock. So basically, if you look through your windshield, all you see is rock.
It's rock.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, the next position is called nothing but sky. See, all you see now is clouds.
You guys ever just, when sales are slow, just come out here and drive on this for the hell of it?
Oh, sure. We do it because, we get so much traffic by the dealership, you know. People actually stop and watch us. So I'm a realist, you know. I'm not going to sit here and say that the gas hasn't hurt us. There's no question about it. But you know what? We still sell them.
Dave Harmon, the guy trying to sell his Hummer, has no test track. He has a driveway, a family to feed, an $800 a month payment, and a 3.5-ton reminder of his regrettable decision. But does he at least have good memories of how it was in better times?
Yes, all the guys at the gas stations and the minivans, all, you know. And nobody wants to be in my shoes and be the idiot that actually did it.
I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
You can see Dave and his Hummer at weekendamerica.org. You can even see his ad for his automobile. By the way, Dave thinks that you would look very, very good behind that wheel.
Dave thinks everyone but him looks good behind the wheel, I'm sure, at this point.
Yes.
And you know, I bought a hybrid 2 years ago. I wasn't really thinking about the gas prices, but it's so interesting that when it has a gauge where you can see what your mileage is. And now
right.
that I can watch that, it's really affecting my driving. And I'm really driving differently to try to save gas.
I have the exact same thing. And California's about to ban cell phones, handheld cell phones. But what are they going to do about me glancing up and down at my mileage every second?
Yeah.
Do you have any tips?
Yeah, actually, I do everything I can not to stop and start. So I'm always trying to go at exactly the right pace so that I can catch the lights and not really have to accelerate or decelerate. And it really makes a huge difference.
Yeah. Sometimes I just wonder, though, how much I'm maximizing my mileage compared to how much I'm annoying the people behind me.
Yeah, I think we're probably annoying the people behind us more. But yes. You know what? If Americans are one thing, we're innovative, especially in times of necessity. So for a little inspiration, we turn to some people around the country who have come up with amazing ways to cope with the high price of gas.
Gas prices are anywhere from $3.99 to $4.09.
We've been hovering around $4 a gallon for the last 30 days.
The diesel prices right now are $4.79.
This is Sheriff Dave Phelan, and I'm the sheriff of Fairfield County, Ohio. Last year at this time, we were spending about $17,000 a month on fuel. Now we are spending about $28,000 per month on fuel. And for a smaller agency, that really causes us a lot of problems. Well, the one thing we have done is we have purchased a golf cart, put some emergency flashers on it and repainted it with the sheriff's emblem on it. And we get up to about 40 miles per gallon. And we were getting in our Crown Vic probably 10, 12 miles per gallon. Plus, on a nice day, it's fun to be in a golf cart. Last weekend, we had our mounted unit out riding horses. We have a number of bicycle patrols that we're going to be putting out. And one thing that really is helped is that most people, when they see a police officer, they see him sitting in a car driving by. You don't have the interaction that you have when you have someone on a horse, someone on a bicycle, someone in a golf cart interacting with the citizens.
Oh, well, I haven't totally worked it out, but this weekend my boyfriend and I are going to be going to a graduation party, and he lives in Inver Grove Heights, which is quite a few miles from where we live in Minneapolis. I am going to map out a trip that will involve taking our bikes, riding them to the light rail station, taking the light rail close to the Mall of America, and from the Mall of America, hopping on a bus, and then definitely hopping on our bikes to get to the party. Well, preparing for trips like this takes a long time. I have to think about my water, what snacks I might need on the way, a smaller purse versus a larger purse,
extra jacket,
extra shoes, maybe something different to wear. So if I'm going to take 2 hours to bicycle, light rail, bus to a place, well, I suppose it'll take me an hour to get ready.
I first started out, you know, I was getting upset with the diesel prices because I have a diesel truck, and so I stated that if the diesel were to ever go $4 a gallon, that I was going to start riding my horse into town, and I was going to start making my bank deposits on horseback through the bank teller window, and it did. It happened, $4, and so sure enough, that's exactly what I did. It seemed like every bank employee came running to the window and said, "What's going on?" You know, and everybody was taking pictures, and he made a deposit, and then I made a deposit. Right now, he's 8 years old. His name is Hitman. His registered name is Jens Icebreak Hitman. He's a registered Tennessee Walker, and I could jump off a cliff with him. He trusts me to no extent. He and I have a bond. We connect. And then we went on up to McDonald's and went through the drive-thru. I had to have my helper, Brenda, punch the button for service because he didn't weigh enough for the light to come on. Anyway, we ordered and sat in front. I tied him to the flagpole, and it was a pretty nice event. Usually, you don't ride a horse through town or through the drive-thru. And I just made the statement that if the prices go up, I'm not going to stay at bellyache or gripe. I'm going to do something about it. And so I saddled my horse up, and we took off.
That was Alan Pierce in Litchfield, Kentucky, Amy Amberg in Minneapolis, and Sheriff Dave Phelan in Fairfield County, Ohio.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
This Father's Day, a daughter battles her war veteran dad for his memories. Coming up on Weekend America. Thank you. this Father's Day weekend. Thank you for sharing some of your time with us. Despite the slumping economy, evidently dads are recession-proof. It looks like we're going to spend about $11 billion this Father's Day. Now, that's a lot less than the $18 billion we usually spend on Mother's Day, but the gap between phone calls on Mother's Day and Father's Day is really starting to close.
The question is, once kids have their father on the telephone that Sunday, what are they actually going to talk to them about?
Exactly. Well, this weekend, reporter Tamara Keith goes to the San Francisco Bay Area to visit her dad, and there's definitely one subject her dad is not going to want to talk about: his experience in Vietnam.
When I was a little girl, 3 or 4, my dad was artistic director for a theater company in Hollywood. The actors and crew were all veterans, war veterans, including my dad. They did plays about war. Growing up, I knew very little about Dad's military history. He enlisted in the Navy before he was drafted. He ended up in Vietnam in 1969 and 70. He was a Navy photojournalist, second class. He was shuttled into all the hot spots to take pictures. He probably witnessed a lot, but he just doesn't talk about it. Most of what my brother Donovan and I know about the war, we learned from the movies Dad made us watch.
It's all we ever see, really, is like once a year on like Veterans Day, Dad pulls out all the Vietnam films and we watch.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning. You know, one time we had a hail bomb.
And then he'll get into analysis of like various actors while we're watching. So we don't quite know why we're watching, whether or not it's like some part of his lived experience that he wants us to understand, or whether it's his trying to remember his friends that died in the war, or any number of things, really.
Smells like victory.
Fast forward a few years. Donovan is in college preparing to audition for a play. He needs a monologue, so he emails Dad. A couple of days later, Dad sends him a script from a play called Viet Damned. It's a dramatic battlefield scene with a soldier raging as his friend is clearly dying in front of him.
Just shut up. I am not leaving you here alone. This place is crawling with gooks. You're not going to die. You can't die. It's not fair. We had plans.
It was intense. Donovan gets another email from Dad. Congratulations on getting a part in the play. Glad you liked the monologue. By the way, I wrote it. This monologue brought back all the old questions about Dad's time in Vietnam. Was this piece of fiction a window into our dad's war experience? Was he trying to tell us something?
It is really a question as to, you know, where all of this is coming from. Like, what did Dad go through?
So I did something really uncomfortable. I went to Dad and asked him about Vietnam. Asked him about the monologue.
What? Why? Well, so what we're trying to figure out is if you were trying to tell us anything by writing this.
Well, that's a good question. It's not a Rorschach test as to who I am as a person. It was an academic exercise.
Dad is really good at answering without answering.
In the monologue, the actor is losing a buddy on the battlefield. Did that happen to you? Did you have buddies? Was it real to you?
Yeah, it was real to my experience, and you do lose people, and buddies, maybe somebody you've known for 5 minutes.
If that monologue is true, if you lived that monologue, then that explains why when I was a kid you told me not to get too close to people.
That would be a really strong, valid assumption.
Huh.
Did he just tell me he lost a friend on the battlefield? It's not at all clear. Whatever happened to Dad in Vietnam, whatever he saw, it was bad. After the war, he didn't pick up a camera for a decade. And I have faint memories of visiting him in a mental ward at a VA hospital.
I was just not adjusting well to being back in the world, as they said.
It was PTSD before they called it that. When I was real young, we were living in the flight path of an airport, and Dad told me every plane overhead made him relive a little bit of the war. And there was an alarm at a business near our house that kept going off in the middle of the night.
And one night I went out and shot the alarm in the middle of the city with a rifle. And it only took me two shots to kill the alarm. And that's how not totally connected to reality I was.
That's the closest Dad has ever come to telling a real war story. And it happened in L.A., not Vietnam.
It's like, I would like to be able to tell you what you want to hear, but I don't know what to tell you because there is no truth that comes out of a war. All there are the stories that you agree with yourself to tell other people, and those stories become the truth.
I guess I don't really need to know what happened to my dad in Vietnam. It's just not worth it. Not worth stirring up those emotions. And in some ways, maybe it's just better to know my dad as he is now.
Tamara Keith will have a little more time to ask questions of her dad. They're sharing pizza this Father's Day.
You know, Des, as I listened to that first exchange between Tamara and her dad, mm-hmm. I just wanted to say, just ask him.
Exactly.
Ask him straight out what happened in Vietnam.
Right.
And maybe that's the journalist in me. That's what we do for a living. But as I kept listening, I started to understand, I think. There were things I never talked about with my dad, even things I know happened to him that I found out from other people.
Mm-hmm.
And my feeling was, I took it as vulnerability, that he would want to keep something to himself. Seemed like maybe he's protecting himself, and I want to help. It made me feel protective of him.
And maybe he was trying to protect you as well. You know, I agree with you that sometimes it's hard to cross that line, but I do think that that changes over time. Like, I've been doing a lot of family history work, and slowly family members are opening up to me about things that happened forever ago, and I realize that they had shame or embarrassment or fear about things that they don't need to be ashamed about anymore. And so mm-hmm. they're starting to tell me these stories. And also, I think knowing about events that happened in my parents' life really helped me understand how my parents chose to parent my brother and me.
I don't know. I think I'm in the leave the past in the past camp.
Yeah, but it doesn't always stay there. One day, Bill, your daughter Susanna might be having some pizza with you on Father's Day and asking some hard questions.
Yeah.
This is Weekend America.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MPA Program.
Sound the moo alarm at high noon. A town clings to its cheesy past. Coming up on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This is the radio show that asks you, what's the soundtrack to your weekend? When you want to get into a space that's all your own, what song do you keep going back to? You have been sharing beautiful stories about what art can do for us, and your tastes are all over the place. If you go to weekendamerica.org, you can find out what's inspirational about acoustic folk and minimalism and show tunes and just about everything. This weekend's soundtrack gets us in the mood for tomorrow's holiday. Mark Kaufman listens to us in Silver Lake, Ohio, and the soundtrack to his weekend is Blues for Big Scotia by Oscar Peterson. What is it about Blues for Big Scotia that makes it your weekend soundtrack?
Generally, when people think of the blues, they think of more traditional blues and somebody singing about sad themes. But this absolutely put a smile on my face. And the first time I heard it, I knew there is some place somewhere in the world where everything is right. And it happened to be in that recording studio at that time.
What is it about this tune that struck you so much?
Well, it was actually my first exposure to jazz. My mother was a pianist, and she wanted to make sure that I learned piano and studied piano, and of course that meant studying classical music. But one day I just happened to hear this, and it was an epiphany. It changed me forever, and I knew that I'd probably play classical music all my life, but jazz was going to be a part of my life, both playing and listening after that.
You've been listening to this tune for, 40-plus years now?
Probably about 45 years.
How has it changed for you over time?
I also think of my late father a lot when I hear this song.
Why do you think of your father?
My dad, as wonderful a man as he was kind of a musical Neanderthal. He listened mostly to elevator music, and he was quite content with that. And what he thought was jazz was that kind of music that he always hated. Well, one day, he had stopped over my apartment, and I happened to have this song on. And while we were talking about things completely unrelated to music, I noticed that my dad's foot was just going right up and down to the music. So I sort of snuck the conversation back over to jazz, and he reiterated his position. He said, "Oh, Mark, you know, I just don't like that kind of music." And then he paused, and he said, "But this is good." And I said, "Well, Dad, this is jazz. This is jazz." And he said something to the effect of, "No, this couldn't be jazz because I like this." And so that moment when my father discovered that maybe he was a jazz fan sticks in my mind. And it's just one of the things that evokes memories of this terrific man who raised me.
Why did that mean so much to you that your dad embraced jazz?
Our fathers are our gateway and our guide into the adult world. And this was something that I was able to actually give back to him. He was an intelligent man. He had a terrific heart. But this was something that I was able to sort of hand back. And there isn't really much that we can do for our parents, and what we can do for our parents is just a cup of water in the ocean of what they do for us. But this will always stick in my mind as something I was able to give him a little bit.
Well, this has been a pleasure. Mark, thanks a lot for sharing your weekend soundtrack.
Thanks for having me on.
I wonder if everyone has a dad song. Mark has Blues for Big Scotia by Oscar Peterson. My dad was into this hip 60s polyphonic vocal group, the Swingle Singers.
My dad, Gladys Knight, Midnight Train to Georgia.
What's your weekend soundtrack? Let us know and tell us the story behind it. Go to weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
Welcome to the weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
Well, today we bring you another in our series of stories about summer travel. Now, we want to take you to those out-of-the-way places that aren't yet kitschy and crawling with tourists.
Think antlers on the walls of the upscale Western restaurant where no patron has ever shot anything.
Of course, now, to be fair, it's hard to hang on to authenticity once you have become a tourist destination. Weekend America's Chrissy Clark visited an old ranch town recently. It's about an hour north of San Francisco called Point Reyes Station. And she found that what makes a town authentic can be in the eye of the beholder.
Point Reyes Station is a little town between Golden Hills on one side and a shallow green bay on the other, a few hundred yards east of the San Andreas Fault. It is a beautiful place. And in the last few years, the town of Point Reyes Station has changed a lot. Even the sound of the place has changed from this to this. At first, I know it's a subtle difference, but let me explain. The first moos you heard are real cows in a real pasture. There used to be lots of cows in town, two blocks off Main Street at a dairy farm that dates back to the early 1900s. The second moos you heard are a recording that blasts out of loudspeakers from a bar on Main Street every day at noon. The noon moo, locals call it. These days, the noon moo is the only way to hear a cow in Point Reyes Station, because last year, the dairy farm closed down. The actual cows were sold and trucked off. You can't hear them or see them or smell them anymore.
Many of the older locals said that when the cows left and the smell and the flies left, that would be the end of Point Reyes.
But it wasn't. Point Reyes is still around, population 818. It turns out the old dairy barn where the cows once lived is still around too. And people don't quite know what to do with it now. John Hulls, a local newspaper columnist who's lived in town for more than 30 years, is showing it to me.
As you can see, the closer you get, the less durable it looks.
It is beautiful, with a peaked, sagging roof and wooden walls, worn and silvering, that look great against the green-gold fields. Recently, John wrote a column about this old barn. He tries to be realistic about it.
It's just an old building that's about to fall down.
But its beetle-infested walls hold something else for John, too. A choice between a world of function and authenticity where barns are for cows versus a world of signs and symbols where barns are for sightseeing to remind you of the cows the town used to have.
If you only focus attention on the signs and symbols, then you end up living in a simulacra, a simulated world. You cannot have an authentic barn without having the dairies.
John, I should say, likes to read French philosophy in his spare time. He also liked living near a working dairy barn, owned by a local family that sent their kids to the local school and employed other local families. Now that the dairy is closed, John would just as soon see the old barn torn down. Otherwise, for him, it's just one more bit of quaintness for the tourists to admire. Every year, 2 million people visit this town, John says, as he shows me around.
There are quite a few bed and breakfasts around. They sort of spring up with great abandon. Houses become galleries. The old livery stable is now a gym and offices.
Well, this was all the pasture land, needless to say. Last summer, they took all the fences down, took all the buildings down except for the old barn.
Bob Giacomini grew up next to this old dairy barn. His dad owned it. Bob's driving me around the property in his pickup truck.
This is our home. This is our home that we grew up in right here, the ranch home here. This is what we've converted into a B&B. There's some people staying here right now. But this is where I was raised.
We pull over and get out to look at the place. Bob's dad bought this ranch in 1945 when there were 150 dairies in the area. Now there are less than 30. Back then, the routine was pretty much the same on every ranch. Wake up before sunrise, milk the cows.
Sometime in the middle of the day, if you were lucky, you got a half hour's little cat nap, and then go back and do the same thing again. But it's a life where you're your own boss. You're working out in the open air all the time.
Then in the 1960s, the federal government started buying up the farms, turned the land into a national park. Point Reyes National Seashore became the perfect weekend getaway for folks in San Francisco, the perfect stop on a road trip down California's coast. Eventually, the Park Service approached the Giacomini's.
We weren't too excited about selling it to them at that point in time. In fact, we weren't excited at all about doing it. We wanted to keep the ranching and the dairy going there. But as time went on and pressure kept building, and we could see the writing on the wall that the time was going to have to come when we were going to have to just sell it and move on.
It was mostly economics. Ranching was getting more expensive, and the family got well over $4 million for the land when they sold it a few years ago. The actual sale price was never revealed. Bob says he remembers the day he and his brother, who ran the ranch, watched the last milk cows get trucked away.
And certainly there were tears in everybody's eyes.
Bulldozers will come in this summer to tear down the dikes that Bob's dad built in the 1940s, dikes that turned hundreds of acres of marshland into some of the region's most fertile pastures. Once the dikes are gone, the creeks will start to meander. The salt water from the bay will seep back in. The pasture will die, and the land will slowly revert back to wetlands.
That's an osprey. We'll see more of them out here, that flying bird right there. It's a hawk that hunts fish, and we'll see a lot more of him the more the water gets in him.
Gordon Bennett is the conservation chair of the local Sierra Club chapter, and we're walking past the old dairy barn. He thinks it's handsome, but it doesn't really interest him. What does interest him is the wetlands restoration area. Gordon worked side by side with the Park Service for 15 years to make this restoration happen. 95% of the coastal wetlands in the United States are gone.
Looking at all the damage that we've done and the simplification that we've imposed on the world, it's nice to look at an area and restore it to its complexity in a way that is self-sustaining, that allows nature to the extent possible to do what it wants to do without human direction.
Since the dairy closed, Park Service scientists have found tiny endangered goby fish here, some of California's last remaining coho salmon, and rare birds called clapper rails, who hide in the marsh grasses. This is the authentic Point Reyes, says Gordon. He says he appreciates the cultural history of the dairy, but the cows are not an endangered species.
Agricultural operations are not an endangered species, but the animals that will use this are, and that's what's important to me.
What do you see?
Well, if you take it out with your finger, okay, crop it out, the landscape flattens to me.
Randy Fleming is trying a little visual experiment with the old dairy barn and his right index finger right now and explaining it to a friend.
There is something about the visual activity, let's say almost the lines of tension of that barn rising to the sky, counteracting the flatness of the wetland environment. And so even from a pure sculptural position alone, this thing is interacting.
Randy moved to town a few years ago after he retired as an architect. He loves cows, but he says restoring the wetlands and retiring the dairy was the right thing to do.
In addition to the smell, which...
which Randy lived upwind from. He's also glad to see more wildlife back in the area, more wildness. But Randy does not want to see the old dairy barn go. He's working with the Park Service to see how much it would cost to repair the thing, maybe turn it into a community center. He wants to do something with it, to save an authentic piece of the town's history.
I think the barn is obviously symbolic or representative of a different time. I'm comforted by seeing it there.
In postmodern French philosophy, this would be called the barn's symbolic or sign value, as opposed to its functional one. Kind of like the noon moo that comes from the bar on Main Street, which is where I go on my way out of town to ponder the slippery nature of authenticity. It can be better done with a drink. I remember a conversation I had about the noon moo with Bob Giacomini, the old dairy farmer. He was driving me back from his old dairy farm to my car on Main Street. We passed by the entrance to the wetlands restoration area, and then the bovine bakery and a little takeout cart called the Chinese Chuck Wagon, and then several B&Bs, one that his family now runs. And Bob told me he likes the noon moo.
I think it's kind of unique. I like it.
I mean, who put it up?
It's kind of corny, but I mean, it's a corny town, you know.
Do you ever worry that the town will get too cutesy, too kind of quaint and...
Yeah, probably getting that now. But you're not going to stop it. It's a fact of life, and so... you know, you might as well admit it and try and take advantage of it a little bit.
Yeah.
What else are you going to do, you know?
Bob Giacomini's family has gone from agriculture to agritourism, from selling milk to selling views of where the milk used to be made, because that's where the money is now. If, like the French philosopher said, authenticity is about using something for its actual function rather than a symbolic one, then maybe a tourist town is as authentic as you can get. In Point Reyes Station, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
Authentic or symbolic? See for yourself. You can check out a slideshow of the old dairy barn, plus the wetland restoration. It's all at our website at weekendamerica.org. And also this weekend, Bob's ranch hands will be milking the herd because, as Bob points out, milk cows don't observe weekends.
This weekend, that Point Reyes dairy barn / sculpture stands juxtaposed with partly cloudy skies and mid-60s. Not so good in the Midwest. More rain this weekend could exacerbate flooding there. Happily, there is other weather going on around the country. And with a look, here's John Mo.
Feeling thoughtful and Midwestern? Swing by New York Mills, Minnesota for the Great American Think-Off. Finalists from a national contest are pondering immigration issues. They'll also contemplate how glad they are to be inside, away from thunder and 67. And if they're real geniuses, they'll figure out why Minnesota has a city called New York Mills. West Fork, Arkansas didn't mean to seem like the setting of a scary movie, just turned out that way. 85 degrees to go with both thunderstorms and tons of bats. Batorama is a chance to learn about bats with speakers and hikes. I hope they cover which bats transform into cheesy actors with slicked hair who say good evening, because that would be good to know. Not pleasant in East Granby, Connecticut, 92 degrees and thunderstorms. But it sure beats having dropsy, or galloping consumption, or putrid fever. Those are just a few diseases from colonial times featured at a presentation of colonial medicine with a costumed interpreter. Turns out HMOs back then didn't even cover leeches. Tough times. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Anyone can go hear a rock concert this weekend. Try just seeing a rock concert. That's next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where people can stay in touch with who they know and what they love. You can discover unsigned musicians, discuss books, share pictures, and keep up with the world. People are talking. Gather.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at Calvert.com.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. Want to hear a concert this weekend? You have options. Death Cab is in Indianapolis. Chattanooga has the big Riverbend Festival going on. Willie Nelson's always on the road. He's in St. Louis now. One thing that's predictable about all of those concerts is those bands will make a lot of racket. Meanwhile, the Sads are an L.A. band that's putting on a silent show tonight. What they do is feed all their instruments into about 80 sets of headphones. If you don't have headphones, then you'll hear the tapping of drum pads and the clicking of keyboards. They originally tried this idea out last November.
The reaction the first time we did this in New York, it was amazing. We planned on only doing a 15-minute set, and there were people basically out on the streets. And people just walking by were just like, wow, I see people playing music, but I don't hear anything. And we wound up doing three different sets so we could accommodate all the people that wanted to experience it. My name is David Scott Stone, and I am with the group The Sads. I am playing modular synthesizer and electronics. Also in the band is Aaron Rose.
Hey, how's it going? I'm a musician and vocalist in The Sads.
And Asuka.
Hello, my name is Asuka Matsumiya. I play keyboards, bass, and sing in the band.
Just kick in the drums, yeah.
Silent performance came up from an idea of I was at Aaron's house and I saw a pair of old 60s Special Ed headphones that looked amazing, and he must have had 50 pairs of them. And I remember listening to loud music as a child on headphones because we couldn't play loud music in my parents' house. The intimacy that you have from listening at headphones at 1 o'clock in the morning when you're a child, I mean, it just carried throughout my life. And whenever I've mixed music or, you know, wanted to listen to something really in depth, I listen to things on headphones.
Basically, when the audience enters the room, what they see is a giant pile of electronic gear. We set up our equipment loosely based around the idea of a campfire, where all the equipment is in the center of the room. And we're surrounding the equipment in a circle facing each other. And then the headphones extend out from that into a larger circumference of a circle. So the audience is completely surrounding the band. It's a much more intimate experience than you would get seeing a live band in another situation, which you wouldn't originally think would be the case.
You know, like, because you hear, like, you see, like, piano or violin or cello, those are, like, wooden instruments. And you expect to hear something very natural and very touching from those instruments because they're made by nature, and you never expect that electronic instruments can give you the same feeling because you just see lots of wires and lots of cords and everything connected.
It's almost like a group meditation, which sounds so completely lame, but there's a sense of connection, I mean, because we're all connected by wires when we're doing this thing. The band is connected by wires, which go to the headphone amps, and the amps then have wires out to the audience, so everybody is completely connected to each other.
The headphones are pretty close together, so you're in close proximity of other people.
They're right on top of each other, you know what I mean? Everybody's touching each other.
There were certainly couples holding hands when we were playing in New York. I know, when I saw that, it was like mission accomplished. What we're working on now is trying to bring people back into the real world, so we're actually fading the music out, and we all start singing at the end of the performance in the room, and we try and fill the room up with our voices again.
I sit by the fire of relentless.
slowly they move from out of the headphones and back into the room acoustics. We came into the awareness of the sound outside the headphones and moving in and out between the acoustic world and the headphone world that we're creating. And, you know, we're going to attempt to bring people in and out of some sort of hopefully hypnotic state if all is working good.
Run away, run away, run away.
The SADS will perform their silent show tonight at the Westwood Art Forum here in Los Angeles. And you can see the SADS perform at our website, weekendamerica.org.
And there's got to be a lot of other kinds of performances this weekend. It's wedding season. I know that lots of people are getting married because it's June. And you know what? I've been watching America's Funniest Videos for years, and it's always the wedding videos that crack me up. It seems like nothing spells disaster like a white dress, a big cake, and some experimental dance moves.
Did you have a Bob Saget-worthy wedding? We want to know. Did the little ring bearer swallow the rings? Did the caterer get the date wrong? Look, everybody at your wedding knows what happened, so you might as well share it with us.
Or did something unexpected and wonderful happen? Speak now, forever hold your peace, weekendamerica.org.
That's another hour of Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. You can download a free podcast of our entire program. Just go to weekendamerica.org. Have a great Father's Day weekend.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independence in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
On the next Weekend America, our series, This Weekend in 1968. It's graduation weekend.
This guy leaned out over the fence, said, what are you up to, man? And I said, well, I want to get arrested tomorrow with you, but they're not letting me in through the gate. And he said, oh, well, we'll find a way.
How one guy stepped out of high school straight into the civil rights movement. Join us.